In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Oh yeah, it's time for us to talk movies. Haven't done it in a couple of weeks. So glad to have the team reassembled here. Pass the Popcorn brought to you by Bangor Mall Cinema 10, where they have a film for everybody in the family. Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Alan Adams from The Main Edge back. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, we missed you.
Yeah, I missed you guys too.
I mean, I got to see you on New Year's Day.
Well, that's right. You
know, not everybody has that privilege.
No, it was a lovely, lovely break, but I'm glad to be back here with you guys.
We were talking in the break about Golden Globes last night. We both watched, and for the most part, things went as expected, but you were a bit surprised by 1917.
Well, it's always interesting to see what direction the Globes are going to go in, because, frankly, you just can never tell. The reality is the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is a very, very small voting body. There's fewer than 100 voting members. And so all it takes is a couple of people to get an idea in their head, and then things kind of go off the rails a little bit. I didn't really disagree with any of the choices. Like, some of them weren't necessarily choices I would have made. 1917 I don't know if it's a good movie. Like, everything I've heard indicates that it is a very good, impressive, both technically and in terms of storytelling. But I won't know until, I think this weekend is when it goes into wide release. So that'll be fun to check that out. Maybe we'll talk about it in the space a week from today.
That sounds good.
But as for the other stuff, I kind of figured Joaquin Phoenix was going to win in the dramatic actor category. Taron Egerton winning for Rocketman was a little bit of a surprise. Deservedly. Like, I mean, he did a great job. I think I said this when the movie came out. I think it was a better performance than Rami Malek in Bohemian Rhapsody. Right. And he won an Oscar. So,
yeah.
What am I? Who am I to say? And then, you know, stuff like... Like, it was great to see Awkwafina being recognized for The Farewell. Like, that's a movie that, again, I haven't seen myself, but everything I've heard is that it's an absolutely just magnificent performance from her. And so, yeah, and then we got to see Brad Pitt get the first of all the trophies that he's going to collect on his march to the Oscars. Although, we'll see what happens with Tom Hanks. I'm curious. Mm. I was kind of surprised they didn't give it to him last night, right, to be truthful, although I think Brad Pitt certainly deserves.
When can we expect Oscar nominations?
I want to say it's like January like 13th. So it's like next week.
Yeah.
And then the turnaround time is ridiculous, like, because the ceremony is February 9th, I think. They've moved it up for reasons that no one seems particularly clear on. Especially since it's going to be a 1-year move, because they're going to have to move back in the season in subsequent years because of stuff like the Super Bowl and the Olympics and all that jazz. So we'll see. But yeah, the Golden Globes, not the disaster it could have been. So right, there's that.
There you go. All right, you saw three movies, and curious to hear what you think of all of them. Let's begin with the one that I'm guessing was probably the least successful of the three. The Grudge.
Like, I mean, we could talk about it if you want to. it's a remake of a 2004 movie of the same name, starring Sarah Michelle Gellar, which is in turn a remake of a Japanese film from 2002 that's actually good. You're an educator. You've used a photocopier or two in your time. A copy of a copy of a copy, and things start to wear a little bit thin.
Yes, you lose a generation each time.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like the last clone in that Michael Keaton movie, Multiplicity. It's like The Grudge is trying to put a slice of pizza in its wallet. You know what I mean? Like, it's that kind of movie. It's one of those things where there's not really a story. It's just like there's this flimsy sort of framework on which they've hung more jump scares than I think I've seen in a movie. It's like every 5 minutes or so, like clockwork. It's like, oh, something creepy. It's like, oh, we're close up on someone and they're looking in a mirror. They're gonna look down. There's gonna be something there when they look up again. It's just so tiresome. And then you throw in the fact that it's a fractured chronology type movie where we bounce back and forth between multiple timelines and multiple storylines and all this stuff. And there's just not enough story there for that to work. And it just makes everything more muddled and confused. The titular grudge is basically, they explain it to you with the title card at the beginning, which is very helpful. but basically, if someone dies in the throes of a massive rage, their spirit lives on and seeks revenge on anyone who crosses its path. Hmm. And it bears a grudge, Rich. Oh. And then if you walk into the house where the event happened, the curse attaches itself to you, and then you carry it around with you, and you ultimately go crazy and murder your family. Like, that's basically how the grudge works. And it happens multiple times in multiple timelines in this movie, just over and over again. It's like, oh, well, yeah. Hey, maybe when the guy whose partner went crazy says, don't go in the house. Yeah, maybe don't go in the house.
Don't go, yeah.
Words to live by just generally. Like, just don't go in the house. All right. And so that's The Grudge.
Enough of that. Let's move on to Greta Gerwig's take on the classic Little Women.
You know, it's funny watching this movie because I wasn't sure how I was going to do with this one because, no matter how voracious a consumer of culture you are, there are always going to be gaps in your cultural understanding. And honestly, there's a Louisa May Alcott shaped hole in my cultural awareness. Like, I've never read the book. I've never seen any of the film adaptations. Literally, all I know about the story is there are four sisters. And I know the infamous spoiler because Rachel spoiled it for Joey on an episode of Friends.
That's right.
And that's really what I've got.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of people who have real affection and fondness for that book. And it's very important to a lot of people. And so I was curious. I was like, okay, well, I have a basic awareness of this story. I'll be very curious to see how it will, how I will enjoy it. You know, and it's Greta Gerwig. Like, she's incredibly talented. Like, she's a gifted director, and she's an even better writer. The cast is stacked. So you're like, okay, so this is obviously going to be a good movie. I don't think I was prepared for how good it is because it's excellent.
Wow.
Gerwig does a great job of sort of framing the story. We have, again, two sort of timelines happening. We've got one set in the time of the March sisters, Joe, played by Saoirse Ronan, Beth, played by Emma Watson, Amy, played by Florence Pugh, who, just by the way, like
Midsummer, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Fighting with My Family. Like, she's had a big year.
Wow. Also,
like, just a really nice and varied sort of year. And she's the one, because I think we're all sort of counting on Ronan being the sort of the top of the list,
right,
as far as this generation. Florence Pugh's closer than I think a lot of people think. Like, she's really talented, and really with a really broad sort of range that you just don't necessarily see a lot of that. But yeah, and then there's the youngest, the ill one, Beth, played by Eliza Scanlon, whose work I was unfamiliar with, but she's also very good. Their mom's played by Laura Dern, and then you've got the kid, the boy next door, Laurie, played by Timothy Chalamet, and his granddad is Chris Cooper. So I mean, it's just stacked. It's set in Civil War times. These four sisters live in Massachusetts with their mom. And they're waiting for their dad to return from war. Like, it's during the Civil War, and he's enlisted in the Union forces, and he's off on the battlefield, and they're waiting for him to come home. And it's basically the story of their lives over those years. The framing device, it takes place a few years in the future. Joe has moved to New York City and become a professional writer. She's established a relationship with a publisher, played by, by the way, Tracy Letts, because he's here too. And so she's sort of grown up and become a writer, but she's writing the sort of sensationalist kind of lurid stuff that was selling at that time. But circumstances lead her to explore the possibility that maybe there's a place for these stories of her youth. In the sort of publishing realm, and that's kind of it. Like, I don't want to go too far into it,
right,
just because there's I know a lot of people out there are probably incredibly familiar with the story, but if you're like me and you don't have that familiarity, like, it's really wonderful to sort of get surprised by some of the things that happen over the course of the film. One of the things that really sort of stunned me, because this movie stuck with me in a way that I didn't think it would. Like, I find myself revisiting moments, just small things, bits of snippets of dialogue, situations. And it's really remarkable what Gerwig has done, because she's taken this sort of timeless piece of Americana, like this really classic tale, and maintained that integrity of time and place while also endowing it with some real and modern sensibilities. Like, I don't know how you even do that, but she really just has this wonderful gift of exploring sort of more modern themes through this, you know, classic lens, because I don't think anyone would have anticipated that her next project after something like Lady Bird was going to be an adaptation of Little Women.
Right.
And for the fact that she did it, not only did it, but did it so beautifully, because it's a beautifully shot, like, it's beautifully constructed, like, it's wonderful to look at. For her to do something like that, it's really genuinely impressive. And then, of course, you have the cast. Saoirse Ronan is exceptional. Florence Pugh, also excellent. The other two sisters aren't as strong, just because they don't necessarily have as much to do character-wise. And then you've got Chalamet's great. Laura Dern, who's also having a hell of a year.
Yeah.
Including last night. And Cooper is great. Bob Odenkirk shows up as their dad. And I'll admit to it being just a touch distracting.
Hmm.
Only because I'm someone who has a deep affection for Mr. Show, and it's one of those moments where he pops up, and for just that split second, you're like, oh my God, is this a Mr. Show? Is this Mr. Show? where's David Cross?
Oh,
like,
dear.
You know, not through any, and that's on me. It's not anything he's doing. It's just like, that's my perception of him. But yeah, like, just across the board, the performances are excellent. Like, it's beautiful to look at. It's a well constructed story, well told. Just a phenomenal experience. Like, I was stunned by how much I enjoyed this movie.
Excellent. And finally, our threesome today, Adam Sandler showing his acting chops in Uncut Gems.
You know, it's really easy to poke fun at Adam Sandler. It's something that, frankly, he invites. Yeah. With his sort of, I think it's safe to call it a sort of half-ass, like, approach to movie making. Like, right. he does a lot of movies that basically exist solely to give him and his friends working vacations. Like, and that's okay. Like, I mean, that's like, people, like, he has found the formula for, you know, being able to do what he wants to do when he wants to do it. And there are enough people out there who enjoy that he's fine. Like, I don't think he's all that interested in broadening in that sense as a, you know, a producer, you know, filmmaker type person. But it's also easy to forget that when he's paired with quality material and with a director who's not only willing but able to really give him a push, like, you can get something really spectacular out of him. Yeah. Like, it's a reminder of just how incredibly talented he is. And this is one of those movies, man. Like, he's like, I would argue that his performance as Howard Ratner in this movie is the best work that he has ever done. Like, ever. For those who are unfamiliar, this movie is written and directed by the Safdie brothers. It's a wonderful sort of like recent past period piece. Like, it's set in 2012, and you wouldn't think that you would want to make notice of the sort of verisimilitude of a period piece that took place less than a decade ago, but it really does evoke 2012 in a way that's difficult to articulate but very clear.
Mm-hmm.
So Howard Ratner played that's the Sandra role. He runs a jewelry store in the New York City's Diamond District. He's having trouble with his wife, played by Idina Menzel, and he's being taken advantage of a little bit by his mistress, who is played by a newcomer by the name of Julia Fox, who's very good. He runs a store, and has a crippling gambling addiction. He is a degenerate gambler of the first degree who owes significant sums of money to bookies all over the city, including a cool $100,000 to a fellow by the name of Arno, played by Eric Bogosian. And he owes all this money. And finally, one of his big plans is starting to come through because he has gotten his hands on a rare black opal, 5,000-6,000 carats, just this magnificent uncut gemstone. And he believes that it is worth, he estimates it's worth at like $1 million. So he's like, he's getting ready to put it up for auction, and that money is going to fix everything. But being the sort of person that he is, it's not that simple. And so he winds up, he gets the gem and is like, he wants to show it off. And so he's got this buddy, this associate named Manami, played by Lakeith Stanfield, who's great in this movie. His job is basically to bring clients to Howard. One of the clients that he's brought on this particular day is NBA superstar Kevin Garnett, played by Kevin Garnett.
Yes.
So Howard, wanting to show off, shows him the opal, and Garnett looks at it and wants it. He must have it. Howard's like, no, it's not for sale. Garnett's like, I have to have it, please. So finally they wind up coming to an arrangement where Garnett borrows it, using his Celtics championship ring as collateral.
Wow.
Yeah. we'll just put it, we'll leave it like this. He should not have let the gemstone out of his sight because things get very complicated. It's a very up and down sort of roller coastery period of days where he is trying to get the gem ready for auction while also holding off all the many creditors who are pursuing him, including gentlemen who don't take nicely to the idea of you not having their money, and they have associates who would like to talk to you about it, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And but as someone who is in the throes of a very real addiction, despite circumstances, he still continues to make ill-advised choices up and down and all around. And it's really just remarkable to experience in the theater. It's 2 hours of solid like tension. Like you're forward in your seat, you're gripping the back of the seat in front of you. Like you're just so swept up in this sort of grimy tension. Like it's like you don't know what's going to happen. Like you're just in this world packed with desperate, terrible people. And you don't know what motivates them besides their own self-interest. And when that's all that motivates you, the sorts of choices that you make are not going to be good ones. And the reality is, every decision Howard makes, it tends to play out as the worst case scenario. And so, yeah, and so that's where we are. And like the movie doesn't work, I don't think, if you don't have someone like Sandler, someone who has this this sort of weird, like he still has it. Like it's the same thing that's powered his whole shtick since his SNL days. Like this weird, like the barely contained anger of arrested development. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Like and he, you know, and too often he uses that as a crutch. And that's basically like he goes with that and he phones it in. What's so great with what the Safdie brothers have done, and I mean the obvious example is Paul Thomas Anderson when he had Sandler in Punch Drunk Love years ago. But it's when they find a way to sort of subvert that energy and to sort of force it down beneath the surface so it's still there, but it's much more toxic. It's much more bottled up, and so that there's this quiet that comes before like the inevitable explosion. Howard is he's a scumbag. Like he's a jerk. Like, he's got gaudy baubles on and a gaudier accent, and he's a jerk who has no concept of anyone's feelings but himself, and yet he's, you know, trying to deal with his family and trying to deal with his mistress and his business and his customers and all these things. and every choice he makes is the wrong one. And you know, you when you're in a situation like that and you're making bad choices, like, you wind up at the bottom of a pretty deep hole pretty quickly. And watching him fall into that hole and try desperately to claw his way out is it's some of the most compelling cinema of the year, I think.
Excellent. I love it. Can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
Uncut Gems 3, reviewed by Alan Adams today on Downtown. Thank you, Al.
My pleasure.